No hope of resolution. The risks were too large if we continued as we were. I didn't have all that much to lose, but she had a family and two teenage daughters attending private school. There's more, she went on. I'm having a serious problem with my daughter, the older one. Her elder daughter. If I remembered correctly, she was the obedient child who never talked back to her parents and got good grades. A serious problem? She can't get out of bed in the morning. Can't get out of bed? Hey, will you please stop repeating everything I say? Sorry, I apologized, but what is her specific problem? She can't get out of bed? That's right. It's been going on for about 2 weeks. She doesn't try to get up. She doesn't go to school. She just lies in bed in her pajamas all day. Doesn't answer when spoken to. I take food to her, but she barely touches it. Has she seen a counselor? Of course, she said. There's a school counselor. No help at all. I thought for a minute, but there was nothing I could say. I'd never even met the girl. So that's why I can't see you, she said. Because you have to stay home and look after her? There's that, but that's not all. She didn't go on, but I understood how she felt. She was terrified and blaming herself as a mother for our affair. It's really too bad, I said. It's fine for you to say that, but it's even worse for me. She could be right, I thought. There's one last thing I wanted to tell you, she said. She took a quick, deep breath. What's that? I think you can become a really good artist, even better than now. Thank you, I said. That gives me some confidence. Goodbye. Take care, I said. When our phone call ended, I went to the living room, stretched out on the sofa, and thought about her as I looked at the ceiling. We had been together so many times, yet never had I thought of painting her portrait. Somehow that feeling had never arisen. Instead, I had sketched her over and over again, in a small sketchbook with a thick pencil, so quickly I hardly removed pencil from paper. In most, she was naked and posing lewdly, spreading her legs to show her vagina, for example, or I sketched her in the act of making love. Simple drawings, but still very real and very vulgar. She loved looking at them. You're really good at drawing naughty pictures, huh? You toss them off, but they're super dirty. It's just for fun, I said. I drew her again and again, then threw the drawings away. Someone might see them, and it didn't make sense to keep them. Still, maybe I should have secretly held on to at least one, to prove to myself she had really existed. I got up slowly from the sofa. The day was only beginning. There were many conversations ahead. Chapter 58. Like hearing about the beautiful canals of Mars. I called Shoko Akikawa. It was just after 9:30, a time when most people are already up and about, but no one picked up the phone. It rang on and on until the answering machine kicked in. We're sorry, but we can't come to the phone right now. Please leave your message after the tone. I left no message. She must be scrambling to deal with her niece's disappearance and sudden return. I kept calling at intervals, but no one answered. I thought of calling Yuzu after that, but I didn't want to bother her while she was working. I could call during her lunch break. With luck, I would get to have a brief talk with her. It wasn't like our conversation would be a long one. I would simply ask if we could meet sometime soon. That was the gist of it. A yes or no question. If the answer was yes, we would set a date and a place to meet. If it was no, that was that. Then, with a heavy heart, I called Masahiko. He picked up right away. He let out a huge sigh when he heard my voice. "Are you home now?" he asked. I told him I was. "Can I call you back in a couple of minutes?" "Sure," I said. He called 15 minutes later. He seemed to be using his cell phone on the roof of an office building or someplace like that. "Where the hell have you been?" he said, his voice uncharacteristically stern. "You disappeared from my father's room without a word. No one knew where you were. I drove all the way to Odawara looking for you." "I'm really sorry," I said. "When did you get home?"
"Last night."
"So you were traipsing around from Saturday afternoon until Tuesday night? Where did you go?"
"To be honest, I have no memory of where I was or what I was doing," I lied.
"So you just woke up and found yourself back home, is that it?"
"Yeah, that's it."
"For real? Are you serious?"
"There's no other way to explain it."
"Sorry, man, I can't buy it. Sounds fake to me."
"Come on, you've seen this sort of thing in movies and novels.
Give me a break. Whenever they pull that amnesia bit, I turn off the TV. It's so contrived."
"Alfred Hitchcock used it."
"You mean Spellbound? That's one of his second-rate films," Masahiko said. "So tell me what really happened."
"I don't know myself at this point. Like, there are these fragments floating around, and I can't figure out how to piece them together. Maybe my memory will return in stages. I'll let you know if that happens, but I can't tell you anything right now. I'm sorry, but you'll have to wait a little longer."
Masahiko paused to digest what I had just said. "All right, then. Let's call it amnesia for now," he said in a resigned voice.
"I gather your story doesn't involve drugs or alcohol or a mental breakdown or a femme fatale or abduction by aliens or anything along those lines."
"No, nothing illegal or contrary to public morals."
"Public morals be damned," Masahiko said. "But clue me in on one thing, would you?"
"What's that?"
"How did you manage to slip out of the nursing home Saturday afternoon? They keep a really strict eye on who comes and goes. A number of famous people are staying there, so they're paranoid about leaks. They've got a receptionist stationed at the entrance, a guard on site 24/7, and security cameras. All the same, you managed to vanish in broad daylight without being spotted or caught on film. How?"
"There's a secret passage," I said.
"Secret passage?"
"An exit no one knows about."
"How did you find that? It was your first time there."
"Your father let me know. Or I should say, he gave me a hint, in a very indirect way."
"My father?" Masahiko said. "You must be kidding. His mind's as mushy as boiled cauliflower these days."
"That's one of the things I can't explain."
"What to do?" Masahiko said with a sigh. "If it were anyone else, I'd say cut the crap. But it's you, so I guess I have to put up with it. Put up with this crazy, no-good bum who spends his whole life painting."
"Thanks," I said. "By the way, how's your father doing?"
"When I got back to the room after my phone call, you were nowhere to be seen and Dad was unconscious and barely breathing. I panicked, man. I couldn't figure out what was going on. I knew it wasn't your fault, but I couldn't help blaming you anyway."
"I really am sorry," I said. I wasn't kidding either. Still, I felt a wave of relief that there was no trace of the Commendatore's body or of the pool of blood on the floor.
"Yeah, you should be sorry. Anyway, I rented a room nearby to be with him, but his breathing stabilized and his condition improved slightly, so I came back to Tokyo the next afternoon. Work was piling up. I'm heading back this weekend, though."
"It's hard on you."
"There's nothing to be done. Like I told you, dying is a major undertaking. It's the person dying who has it hardest, though. So I really can't complain."
"Is there anything I can do?" I asked.
"No, there's nothing," Masahiko said. "But it would help if you didn't dump any more problems on me. Oh yeah, I almost forgot.
When I was at your house on my way back to Tokyo, your friend Menshiki stopped by. The handsome white-haired guy in the snazzy silver Jaguar.
Yes, I met him after that. He said you were there, and that you and he had talked.
Just a few words at your doorstep. He seemed like an interesting guy.
A very interesting guy, I said, putting it mildly.
What does he do?
Not much of anything. He's so loaded he doesn't have to work. He trades stocks and plays the currency market online, but it's more like a hobby for him, a profitable way to kill time.
That's really cool, Masahiko said, impressed. It's like hearing about the beautiful canals of Mars, where Martians row gondolas with golden oars, while imbibing honeyed tobacco through their ears. Warms my heart just hearing about it. Oh yeah, while we're at it, did you ever find the knife I left at your place?
Sorry, but no, I haven't come across it, I said. I don't have a clue where it went. I'll buy you a new one.
Don't sweat it. It probably had a bout of amnesia, just like you. It'll wander back before too long.
Probably, I said.
So the knife hadn't remained in Tomohiko Amada's room either. It had vanished somewhere, just like the Commendatore's corpse and the pool of blood. It might show up here, though, as Masahiko had said. Our conversation ended there. We vowed to get together again soon and hung up. After that, I drove my dusty old Corolla station wagon down the mountain to the shopping plaza. I went to the supermarket where I toured the aisles with the neighborhood housewives. From the looks on their faces, they weren't thrilled by their morning shopping. Not a whole lot of excitement in their lives. No ferry boat rides in the land of metaphor, that's for sure. I tossed what I needed, meat, fish, vegetables, milk, tofu, the whole lot, into my shopping cart and paid at the register. I saved 5 yen by bringing my own bag. Then I went to a discount liquor store and bought a 24-pack of Sapporo. Back home, I arranged most of what I had purchased in the fridge, including 6 cans of beer. I wrapped what needed to be frozen in plastic and stuck it in the freezer. I set a big pot of water on the stove and parboiled the asparagus and broccoli for salads. I boiled a few eggs, too. In the process, I managed to kill most of the morning. Nevertheless, there was still time to spare. I considered following Menshiki's example and washing my car, then realized it would get dirty again in no time flat, and tossed the idea. Parboiling vegetables was much more productive. I called Yuzu's architectural firm shortly after noon. Actually, I wanted to wait until my feelings had settled down before talking to her, but at the same time I didn't want to delay acting on what I had decided in the darkness of the pit, even for a single day. Otherwise, something might cause my feelings to change. Yet the receiver weighed a ton in my hand. A cheerful-sounding young woman answered. I gave her my name and asked to talk to Yuzu.
Are you her husband? She chirped.
Yes, I replied. To be precise, I wasn't, of course, but there was no reason to go into details over the phone.
Please hold on, she said.
I waited for quite a long time. I had nothing in particular to do, so I stood there leaning on the kitchen counter, receiver to my ear, biding my time until Yuzu came to the phone. A big black crow passed right in front of the window. Its glossy feathers gleamed in the sunlight.
Hello, said Yuzu.
We exchanged a simple greeting. I had no idea how a just divorced couple was supposed to address each other, how much distance was appropriate. So I kept it as brief and conventional as possible. How have you been?
I've been fine.
And you? Like a summer shower, our words were sucked up the moment they struck the parched soil of reality. I mustered my courage. I thought we should get together and talk about a number of things face to face. I said.
What sorts of things are you talking about?
Yuzu asked. I hadn't expected that response,
Why hadn't I? So I was at a loss for words. What did I mean by things? I haven't thought it through that far, I stammered. But you want to talk about a number of things, correct? That's right. It occurred to me that we ended up like this without ever having talked. She thought for a moment. To tell the truth, she said, I'm pregnant. I'm happy to see you, but don't be shocked to see how big my belly's grown. I know, Masahiko told me. He said you asked him to. That I did, she said. I don't know how big you've gotten, but I'd like to see you in any case. If it's not too much of an imposition. Can you wait a moment? She asked. I waited. She appeared to be leafing through her appointment book. Meanwhile, I tried hard to remember what kind of songs the Go-Go's sang. I doubted they were as good as Masahiko had claimed, but then maybe he was right, and my view was perverse. Next Monday evening is good for me, Yuzu said. I did the calculation in my head. Today was Wednesday, so Monday was 5 days away. The day Menshiki took his empty bottles and cans to the pickup spot, a day I didn't have to teach drawing in town. That meant I was free, no need to check my schedule. What did Menshiki wear when he took out his garbage, I wondered. It's good for me too, I said. Just give me a time and place and I'll be there. She named a coffee shop not far from the Shinjuku Gyuen Mai station. The name brought back memories. It was not far from her office, and we had met there often when we were still living together as a married couple. After she finished work, usually before we went out someplace for dinner, there was a little oyster bar a short distance away, which offered fresh oysters at a reasonable price. She loved eating their small oysters loaded with horseradish and washed down with chilled chablis. Was the restaurant still in the same spot? Can we meet there shortly after 6? I said that'd be fine. I'll try not to be late. That's all right. I'll wait. Okay. See you then, she said, and hung up. I stared at the receiver in my hand for a moment. So I would see Yuzu again. My estranged wife, soon to bear another man's child. The place and time had been set. Our conversation had gone without a hitch. Yet had I done the right thing? I wasn't at all sure. The receiver still weighed heavy in my hand, like a phone built back in the Stone Age. When it came down to it, though, could anything be completely correct or completely incorrect? We lived in a world where rain might fall 30% or 70% of the time. Truth was probably no different. There could be 30% or 70% truth. Crows had it a lot easier. For them, it was either raining or not raining, one or the other. Percentages never crossed their minds. Talking to Yuzu had left me at loose ends. I sat in the dining room for an hour, mostly looking at the clock on the wall. I would see her on Monday, and we would talk about a number of things. We hadn't seen each other since March. It had been a chilly Sunday afternoon then, rain quietly falling. Now she was 7 months pregnant. A major change in her life. I, on the other hand, was still just me. True, I had drunk the water of the land of metaphor only a few days earlier, and had crossed the river that divided presence and absence, but I wasn't sure if the experience had changed me or not. Finally, I called Shoko again, but no one came to the phone. Instead, it switched to the answering machine. I gave up and sat down on the sofa. I had made all my calls, and nothing more needed to be done. I hadn't set foot in the studio in what felt like ages, and part of me wanted to get back to my easel, but I couldn't think of anything in particular that I wanted to paint. I put Bruce Springsteen's The River on the turntable, then I lay on the sofa, closed my eyes, and listened. When the A side of the first LP had finished, I turned it over and listened to the B side. Albums like The River have to be heard in this fashion. After Independence Day wraps up the A side, you take the record in both hands, turn it over, and carefully lower the stylus. Hungry Heart fills the room. What was the point of listening to The River any other way? In my personal opinion, when CDs strung together the sides of records like The River, they spoiled the experience. The same was true of Rubber Soul and Pet Sounds. Great music should be presented in its proper form and listened to in a proper manner. Whatever the case, the E Street Band's performance was a knockout. The band revved up the singer, and the singer inspired the band. As I zoned in on the music, I could feel my worries fading. I was lifting the needle from the first record when I realized that, perhaps, I should give Manshiki a call. We hadn't spoken since the day before, when he had rescued me from the pit. Yet somehow, I didn't really feel like it. This happened on occasion. He was a fascinating guy, but there were times I really didn't want to talk to him. The gap between us was vast. Why should that be? At any rate, I didn't feel like hearing his voice at that particular moment. So I gave up. I'd call him later. After all, the day had just begun. I put the second record of The River on the stereo. But just when I was settling back to listen to Cadillac Ranch, all gonna meet down at the Cadillac Ranch, the telephone rang. I lifted the needle and went into the dining room to answer it. I figured it was Manshiki. As it turned out, it was Shoko. "Have you been trying to reach me this morning?" she began. "That's right," I replied. I had tried on several occasions. I heard yesterday from Mr. Manshiki that Maria had returned home, so I wondered how she was. "Yes, she came back safe and sound, yesterday afternoon. I called you a number of times to let you know, but there was no answer, so I tried contacting Mr. Manshiki. Did you go somewhere?" "Yes, I had to look after urgent business some distance from here. I got back last night. I wanted to contact you earlier, but there was no phone where I was, and I don't carry a cell phone," I said. It wasn't a complete lie. "Maria returned all by herself yesterday afternoon, covered in mud, but no serious injuries, thank goodness. Where was she all that time?" "We don't know yet," she said in a hushed voice, as if afraid that her phone was tapped. "Maria won't tell us what happened. We had filed a missing persons report, so the police came and asked her all sorts of questions, but she wouldn't tell them anything, not a single word. So they gave up and left, saying that they'd come back when she'd had more time to recover, that at least she had made it home and that she was safe. But she won't tell either her father or me anything. You know how stubborn she can be."
"But she was covered in mud, correct?"
"Yes, her whole body. Her school uniform was torn up too, and her arms and legs were scratched. We didn't have to take her to the hospital, though. None of her injuries was that serious."
Just like me, I thought. Muddy, clothing in tatters. Could we have wormed our way back to this world through the same narrow tunnel?
"And she won't speak?" I asked.
"No, not a single word since she came home. Not just words, either. She hasn't made a sound. As if someone had stolen her tongue."
"Do you think some kind of trauma might have left her in shock? Taken away her voice?"
"No, I don't think so. I think she's made up her mind not to say anything, a vow of silence, if you will. She's done this kind of thing before, when she's furious about something, for example. Once she's made up her mind like this, she tends to stick to it. That's the sort of child she is."
"There's no question of criminal acts, right? Like kidnapping or unlawful confinement?"
"I can't tell. The police say they'll come back to ask more questions once she's had a chance to calm down, so maybe we'll find out then," Shoko said. But I do have a favor to ask, if it's not too much of an imposition.
What might that be?
Would you try to talk to her? Just the two of you? There may be things she'll only open up to you about. She might reveal more about what happened if you're there.
I stood there with the receiver in my right hand, considering her suggestion. If Maria and I were alone together, what was there to discuss? I couldn't begin to imagine. I had my own riddles to unravel, and she, most likely, had hers. If we laid one set of riddles over the other, what answers could possibly emerge? Still, I had to see her. There were things we had to talk about.
Of course, I'd be happy to, I said. Where would you like me to go?
Oh no, please let us come to you, as always. I think that's best. If you don't mind, of course.
No, that's fine with me, I said. I'm free all day. Please come when it's convenient for you.
Would it be all right if we came now? She's home from school today. If she's willing, of course.
Please tell her she doesn't have to talk. That there are things on my end that I'd like to tell her, I said.
Very well, I'll tell her exactly that. I'm dreadfully sorry to keep imposing on you like this, said the beautiful aunt.
Then she quietly hung up the phone. The phone rang again 20 minutes later. It was Shoko.
We'll be coming at 3 o'clock, she said. Maria has said she's willing. Well, she gave a small nod, is more accurate.
I said I would expect them at 3.
Thank you so much, she said. I'm at my wit's end. I don't understand what's going on or what I should be doing.
I wanted to tell her I felt the same way, but I didn't. That's not the response she was seeking. I'll do what I can. I can't be sure if it will work, but I'll try my best, I said. Then I hung up. I stole a look around the room as I put down the receiver, on the off chance that the Commendatore might be in the vicinity, but he was nowhere to be seen. I missed him, the way he looked and his odd way of speaking, but I would never lay eyes on him again. With my own hand, I had driven a knife through his tiny heart, the razor-sharp carving knife Masahiko had brought to my house, all for the purpose of rescuing Maria from someplace. I had to find out where that someplace was.
Chapter 59. Until Death Separated Us. Before Maria arrived, I took another look at her portrait, so close to done. I could picture exactly what it would look like if I ever finished it. Sad to say, though, I never would. There was no way around that. I had no good explanation for why I couldn't complete the painting, no logical argument, just the strong feeling that it had to be that way. The reason, I expected, would reveal itself in stages. What was clear now was that I was fighting a very dangerous opponent. I had to be on my toes every second. I went out to the terrace, sat in a deck chair, and stared across the valley at Menshiki's white mansion. Handsome, colorless Menshiki, he of the white hair. We only talked for a moment at your door, but he seemed like an interesting guy, Masahiko had said. A very interesting guy, I had corrected him. At this stage of the game, though, I would have to say a very, very, very interesting guy. A few minutes before 3, the familiar blue Toyota Prius rolled up the slope and parked in its usual spot in front of my house. The engine stopped, the driver's door opened, and Shoko Akikawa got out. Most elegantly, pivoting in her seat, knees tight together. A moment later, Maria emerged from the passenger seat. Most reluctantly, her movements slow and sluggish. The morning clouds had sailed off somewhere, and the sky was the clear blue of early winter.
The soft hair of the two women danced in the cold wind coming off the mountain. Maria brushed the hair from her eyes in an impatient gesture. Maria was in a skirt, unusual for her, a wool skirt of navy blue. It reached her knees. Beneath was a pair of dark blue tights. Her white blouse was covered by a cashmere V-neck sweater. The sweater was a deep purple, the color of grapes. Her shoes were dark brown loafers. In that outfit, Maria looked like a well-brought-up child from a well-off family, a healthy, pretty, utterly conventional girl. You could see nothing eccentric about her, just that her chest was almost flat. Shoko was wearing snug, light gray slacks, gleaming black low-heeled shoes, a long white cardigan fixed with a belt around her waist. Her breasts stood out proudly beneath the cardigan. She was carrying a black purse made of what looked like enamel, the sort women commonly carry, though their contents have always mystified me. Maria appeared a bit at a loss, with no pockets to plunge her hands into. They were so different in age and stage of maturity, this young aunt and her niece, yet both were so lovely. I observed their approach through the parted curtains. When they walked side by side, the world brightened a little, as when Christmas and New Year's arrive in tandem each year. The doorbell chimed, and I went to open the door. Shoko greeted me politely, and I ushered them inside. Maria said nothing. Her lips were set in a straight line, as if someone had stitched them together. She was a strong-willed girl. Once she made up her mind about something, she never backed down. As before, I led them to the living room. Shoko launched into a string of apologies, but I cut her off. This was no time for social niceties. "If you don't mind, could you leave Maria and me alone for a while?" I said, getting straight to the point. "I think that's best. Please come back in about 2 hours. Would that be possible?" "Oh, well, certainly," the young aunt said. She seemed a little flustered. "If it's all right with Maria, then it's all right with me." Maria gave a slight nod. It was all right with her. Shoko Akikawa consulted her small silver watch. "Then I'll come back at 5 o'clock. I'll be waiting at home, so please call if you need anything." I told her we would. Looking worried, Shoko paused uncertainly, clutching her black purse. Then she appeared to make up her mind, for she took a deep breath, smiled a bright smile, and left. There was the sound of the Prius's engine starting. I couldn't really hear it, but I assume it did. And the car disappeared down the slope. Maria and I were left alone in the house. The girl sat on the sofa and looked down at her lap, her lips still set in a stubborn line and her knees pressed together. Her pleated blouse was neatly ironed. A deep silence followed. Finally, I spoke up. "You don't have to say a word," I began. "You can stay quiet as long as you want, so try to relax. I'll do the talking. All you have to do is listen. All right?" Maria raised her eyes and looked at me, but she didn't speak, nor did she nod or shake her head. She merely stared in my direction. Her face showed no emotion. I felt as if I were gazing at the full moon in winter. Perhaps she had made her heart like the moon for the time being, an icy mass of rock floating in the sky. "First, I need your help with something," I said. "Can you come with me?" I rose and headed to the studio. A moment later, she got up and followed. The room was chilly, so I lit the kerosene stove. When I pulled back the curtains, the mountainside was bright in the sun. Maria's portrait in progress was sitting on an easel, close to finished. She glanced at it, but then quickly looked away, as if she had glimpsed something she shouldn't have. I crouched down, removed the cloth I had draped over Killing Commendatore, and hung the painting on the wall. I asked Maria to sit on the stool to observe it more closely.
You've seen this painting before, right?
Maria gave a small nod.
It's called Killing Commendatore. At least that's what was written on its wrapping. It's one of Tomohiko Amada's most perfect works, though we don't know exactly when he painted it. It's beautifully composed and masterfully drawn. Each character is fully realized and utterly convincing. I paused for a moment, waiting for my words to sink in.
Yet this painting was wrapped up and closeted away in the attic of this house, I went on, where no one would ever see it. When I stumbled upon it and brought it downstairs, it had been gathering dust for a very long time. Apart from the artist, you and I are probably the only people who have ever looked at it. Your aunt could have too on your first visit, but for some reason it didn't catch her eye. I don't know what made Tomohiko Amada hide it in the attic. It's such a brilliant work, one of his true masterpieces. So why would he keep it from the world?
Maria didn't respond. She sat on the stool, her eyes fixed on Killing Commendatore. I continued. As if on cue, weird things have happened one after another since I stumbled on this painting. First, Mr. Manshiki went out of his way to make my acquaintance.
Maria nodded slightly. Then I uncovered that strange hole behind the shrine in the woods. I heard a bell ringing in the middle of the night and traced it to that spot. It was coming from beneath a pile of stones. They couldn't be moved by hand, they were too big and too heavy. So Manshiki arranged for a landscaper to come in with his backhoe. I didn't understand why Manshiki would go to such lengths, and I still don't. At any rate, the stones were moved at great cost of time and money. Underneath them was a hole, a round pit about 6 feet across, made of smaller stones tightly set together in a perfect circle. Who built it and for what purpose is a mystery. Of course, you know about the pit.
Maria nodded.
The Commendatore came out of that opened pit. This guy. I went up to the painting and pointed to the figure. Maria looked at him, but her expression didn't change. He looked exactly the same as you see here. Same face, same clothes. But he was only 2 feet tall. Very compact, and with a peculiar way of speaking. For some reason, I seemed to be the only person able to see him. He called himself an idea, and he said he had been stuck in that pit. In other words, Mr. Manshiki and I had set him free. Do you get what he meant by idea?
Maria shook her head no.
It's hard for me too. The way I understand it, an idea is a type of concept. But not all concepts are ideas. Love, for example, is not an idea. But ideas are what make love possible. Without ideas, love cannot exist. This discussion can go on forever, though, and to tell you the truth, I'm not even sure of the correct definitions. Anyway, an idea is a concept, and concepts have no physical shape. They are pure abstractions. Nevertheless, this idea temporarily borrowed the form of the Commendatore in the painting to make itself visible to me. Do you follow me so far?
Pretty much. Maria broke her silence for the first time. I met him too.
You did? I exclaimed. I looked at her in stunned silence. Then I recalled what the Commendatore had said to me in the Izu nursing home.
I met her not long ago, he had told me. We exchanged a few words.
So you met the Commendatore too?
Maria nodded.
When? Where?
At Mr. Manshiki's, she said.
What did he say?
Maria clamped her lips together again. To signal, it seemed that she didn't want to talk any more for the moment. I didn't push her further.
Other characters in this painting have appeared as well, I said. For example, the man in the lower left-hand corner of the painting, the bearded guy with the strangely shaped face. Right here. I pointed to Long Face. I call him Long Face, and he's a weird one, all right. He's about 2.5 feet tall. He slipped out from the painting, too. I caught him holding up the cover of his hole just as he is doing here, and he helped me reach the underground world. I had to get a bit rough, though, before he gave me directions. Mario looked at Long Face for some time, but she didn't say anything. I continued. I walked through that dim world, climbing hills, crossing a rapid river, until I met the pretty young woman you see right here. This person. I call her Donna Anna after the character in Mozart's opera Don Giovanni. She's also very small. She led me to a tunnel in the back of a cave. Then she and my dead sister helped me worm my way through to where it ended. If they hadn't cheered me on, I never would have made it. I'd have been trapped in the underworld forever. My hunch, though of course it's pure guesswork, is that Donna Anna in this painting may be the young woman Tomohiko Amada loved when he was a student in Vienna. She was executed as a political prisoner 70 years ago. Mario looked at Donna Anna in the painting, her face still as impassive as the white winter moon. Then again, Donna Anna could have been Maria's mother, stung to death by a swarm of hornets. Perhaps she was the one who had protected Maria. Depending on who was looking at her, Donna Anna might embody many things. Of course, I didn't say this out loud. Then we have this man here, I said. I turned the painting, leaning against the wall around, so we could see its front. It was my portrait in progress, the man with the white Subaru Forester. On the surface, it was just thick layers of paint, 3 colors in all. Behind those layers, though, was the Subaru Forester guy. I could see him, though other people couldn't. I showed you this before, didn't I? Maria gave a firm nod, but said nothing. You told me it was finished as it was. Maria nodded again. I call the person portrayed here, or the person I must eventually portray, the man with the white Subaru Forester. I ran across him in a small coastal village in Miyagi Prefecture. Our paths crossed twice, in a very mysterious and meaningful way. I have no idea what sort of person he is, I don't even know his name. But a moment came when I realized I had to paint him. I was compelled to. I started painting him from memory, but had to stop when I reached a certain point. So I painted over him like this. Maria's lips were still set in a straight line. Then she shook her head from side to side. That man is really scary, she said. That man? I said. I followed her eyes. They were fixed on the man with the white Subaru Forester. Do you mean the painting, or the man? She gave another firm nod. Despite her fear, she seemed unable to look away. Can you see him? She nodded. I can see him behind the paint. He's standing there looking at me, wearing a black cap. I turned it around and set it back, face against the wall. You have the ability to see the man with the Subaru Forester standing there. Most people don't, I said. But I think it's better if you don't look at him anymore. There's probably no need at this stage. Maria nodded as if in agreement. I don't know if the man with the white Subaru Forester is of this world or not. It's possible that someone or something merely borrowed his form, in the same way an idea borrowed the form of a commendatore. Or it could be that I saw part of myself reflected in him. But when I was surrounded by real darkness, it was no mere reflection, believe me. It was a tangible, living, moving thing, The people in that land called it a double metaphor. I do plan to finish the painting someday, but not yet. It's still too early and too dangerous. Some things shouldn't be recklessly dragged into the light, but I may not be... Maria was looking straight at me without saying a word. I found it difficult to continue. Anyway, thanks to the help of many people, I was somehow able to cross the underworld and squeeze through a narrow black tunnel to make my way back to this world. At virtually the same moment, you were freed from somewhere. I can't believe that was a mere stroke of luck. On Friday, you disappeared somewhere for 4 days. Then on Saturday, I disappeared for 3 days. On Tuesday, we both returned. There has to be a connection. My guess is that the Commendatore connected us. And now he's gone from this world. He fulfilled his role and moved on. Only you and I are left. We're the only ones who can close the circle. Do you believe what I'm saying? Maria nodded. That's what I wanted to tell you. Why I asked to talk to you alone. Maria's eyes were trained on my face. No one else would believe me, I went on, even if I told the truth. They'd think I was nuts. I mean, the story just doesn't fly. It's too far removed from reality, though I figured you'd believe me. And then I'd have to show them killing Commendatore. Without that painting, nothing I said would make sense. But I don't want anyone else to see it. Only you. Maria kept looking at me. She didn't speak, but I could see the sparkle slowly returning to her eyes. Tomohiko Amada invested everything, all of himself, in this painting. It's filled with his emotion, as though he painted it with his own blood and flesh. Truly a once-in-a-lifetime work of art. He did it for himself, but also for those who were no longer of this world, a kind of requiem to their memory, to purify the blood they had shed.
Requiem?
A work to bring peace to the spirits of the dead and heal their wounds. That's why he didn't expose it to public view. The critical reception, the accolades, the financial rewards, they had no meaning. He wanted none of those things for this painting. It was enough for him to know that he had created it, and that it existed somewhere, even if it was wrapped up in paper and hidden in an attic where no one would ever see it. I want to respect his feelings. The room was quiet for a while. You've played around here since you were small, right? Using that secret passageway of yours. Isn't that so? Maria nodded. Did you ever meet Tomohiko Amada?
I saw the old guy, but I never talked to him. I just hid and looked at him from far away. When he was painting. I mean, I was trespassing, right?
I nodded. The image was all too real. Maria in the shrubbery, peeking into the studio. Tomohiko Amada on his stool, intently wielding his brush. The thought that he was being observed a million miles from his mind.
You asked me to help you with something, Maria said.
So I did. There's one thing, I said. I'd like you to help me wrap up these two paintings and hide them in the attic, where no one can see them. Killing Commendatore and the man with the white Subaru Forester. I don't think we need them right now. That's where I could use your help. Maria nodded, but didn't say anything. Truth be told, this was a task I really didn't want to do alone. More than help, I needed someone to act as an observer and witness. Someone tight-lipped, whom I could trust to share the secret. I went to the kitchen and got some twine and a utility knife. Then Maria and I packed up Killing Commendatore. We wrapped it carefully in the same brown washi, the traditional Japanese paper it had been in before, bound it with twine, draped it in a white cloth, and then tied it again, firmly, to make it difficult for anyone to unwrap. The thick paint on the man with the white Subaru Forester wasn't quite dry, so we wrapped it more loosely. Then we carried the two paintings to the closet of the guest bedroom. I climbed to the top of the stepladder, raised the trap door to the attic, much like Longface had pushed up the square lid to his hole, come to think of it, and climbed up. The air was chilly there, but a pleasant kind of chilly. Maria handed the paintings up to me. Killing Commendatore went first, followed by the man with the white Subaru Forester. I leaned them next to each other against the wall. All of a sudden, I sensed I had company. I gulped. Someone was there. I could feel a presence. Then I saw the horned owl. Probably the same owl I had seen the first time. The night bird was perched on the same beam as before, still as a statue. He didn't seem particularly concerned when I moved in his direction, also like the first time.
"Hey, come up and see something," I whispered to Maria. "Something very cool. Try not to make any noise."
Looking curious, Maria mounted the ladder and crawled through the opening into the attic. I pulled her up the last step with both hands. The floor of the attic was covered with a fine white dust, but she didn't show any concern that it would get on her wool skirt. I sat down and pointed out the horned owl to her. She knelt beside me and looked at the bird, entranced. It was very beautiful, like a cat that had sprouted wings. "It's been living here the whole while," I whispered to her. "It goes out to hunt in the forest in the evening and flies back in the morning to sleep. That's its entrance there." I pointed at the air vent with the hole in its screen. Maria nodded. I could hear the faint sound of her breathing. We sat there side by side without speaking, looking at the owl. Showing little interest in us, the owl sat there quietly, a model of discretion. The owl and I had a tacit understanding that we would share the house. One of us was active during the day, the other at night. In that way, the domain of consciousness was shared equally, half and half. Maria reached over and took my hand in hers. Her head came to rest on my shoulder. I gently squeezed her hand back. Comey and I had spent long hours together like this. We were close as brother and sister. Our feelings had flowed back and forth in a very natural way, until death separated us. I could feel the tension drain from Maria's body. Little by little, that part of her that had become so rigid was beginning to unclench. I stroked her head on my shoulder, her soft, straight hair. When my hand touched her cheek, I realized she was crying. The tears were so warm, it felt as if blood was spilling from her heart. I continued to hold her like that. The girl had needed to cry, but she hadn't been able to, probably for a very long time. The horned owl and I kept watch over her as she wept. The rays of the afternoon sun angled through the hole in the broken vent. White dust and silence surrounded us. Nothing more. Dust and silence that seemed to have been passed down from antiquity. We could hear no wind. On his beam, the horned owl mutely preserved the wisdom of the forest, a wisdom also bequeathed from the distant past. Maria wept for a long time. She made no sound, but the trembling of her body told me she was still crying. I kept stroking her hair, as if she and I were heading upstream along the river of time. Chapter 60. If that person had pretty long arms.
I was at Mr. Manshiki's house, Maria said. The whole 4 days.
She had stopped crying and was talking again. She and I were in the studio. Maria was perched on the round stool, her knees touching as they peeked out from beneath her skirt. I was leaning on the windowsill. I could see how pretty her legs were. Her bulky tights couldn't hide that. When she matured a bit more, those legs would attract the gaze of many men. By then, her chest would have filled out too. Now, however, she was just a lost and confused girl, wavering on the threshold of adulthood.
You were at Mr. Manshiki's? I asked.
I'm not sure I understand. Can you fill me in a little?
I needed to know more about him, so I went to his house. I had to find out why he was watching our home through those binoculars every night. I think he bought the big house across the valley just to do that, to spy on us. I couldn't understand why he would do something like that. I mean, it was so not normal. I thought there had to be some kind of reason.
So you went to pay him a visit? Maria shook her head no.
I didn't pay him a visit. I snuck in, secretly. And then I couldn't get out.
You snuck in?
Yes, like a burglar. I didn't plan it like that, though.
When her morning classes ended on Friday, Maria slipped out the back door of the school. If a student was unexpectedly absent in the morning, the school called their family. But no phone call was made when a student missed his or her afternoon classes. There was no clear reason for this policy. That's just the way things were done. Maria had never skipped out before, so she figured if she got caught, she could talk her way out of trouble. She hopped on a bus and got off close to where she lived. But instead of heading home, she turned up the opposite slope, toward Manshiki's house. At first, Maria had no intention of sneaking in. The idea never crossed her mind. Yet she wasn't planning to ring Manshiki's doorbell and invite herself in, either. The fact was, she went there with no plan in mind. She was simply drawn to the White Mansion, like a metal filing to a powerful magnet. She couldn't solve the mystery of Manshiki's behavior merely by standing outside his wall. She knew that much. Yet she couldn't stifle her curiosity. Her legs carried her to his gate, under their own volition. It was a very long climb. When she turned and looked back, she could see the ocean sparkling between the mountains. His house was surrounded by a high wall with a sturdy electrically operated gate positioned at the entrance. Security cameras were set on each side. One of the gate's pillars had a security company's logo stuck to it. She had to approach with care. She hid behind some bushes and took stock of the situation. She could spot no movement, either inside or outside the house. No one entered or left, and no noise of any kind came from within. After wasting half an hour hanging around with nothing to do, she had given up and was preparing to leave when she saw a van roll up the hill. A minivan from a parcel delivery service. It stopped in front of the gate, a door opened, and a uniformed young man jumped out, clipboard in hand. He walked to the gate and rang the bell. There was a brief exchange with someone over the intercom. When the big wooden gate started to slowly swing in, the young man hurried back to his van and drove inside. Maria had no time to think things through. The moment the van entered, she leapt from the bushes and sprinted as fast as she could through the closing gate. It was pretty close, but she managed to slip through a split second before it shut. The security cameras might have picked her up, but no one came out to challenge her. Dogs, though, were a scarier proposition. A guard dog might be prowling the grounds. She hadn't considered that before racing in. The instant the gate closed behind her, though, the possibility occurred to her. A property this extensive could easily have a Doberman or a German Shepherd running loose. A big dog like that would be a problem. Maria was afraid of dogs. But as luck would have it, none appeared. She heard